like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest on today's show is Laura Hagen, Managing Director of Wildlife at Humane World for Animals, formerly called the Humane Society of the United States. An attorney and veteran animal advocate, Hagen oversees a broad portfolio of wildlife issues at Humane World. Her multifaceted position includes recently identifying and spotlighting a circumstance that even those who pay close attention to animal welfare matters may find startling. That is, exactly a decade after Ringling Brothers halted the use of elephants in their shows, it turns out 14 elephants are still regularly forced to hit the road and perform in other circuses. The situation may actually be more egregious than it initially sounds, starting with the detail that many of these elephants are in their mid to late 50s. These animals are owned by 6 exhibitors who rent their elephant shows to other exhibitors in venues such as Shrine and other circuses, fairs, and Renaissance festivals each year. In the periods when the elephants are not forced to travel and perform, they are warehoused at roadside zoos in Missouri, Oklahoma, Florida, Indiana, and Texas. These facilities are passed off as sanctuaries or educational entities, with many offering dangerous, cruel encounters that compromise the elephant's well-being and public safety. We'll ask Laura for information and insights on this disturbing plight and guidance on what we can do to improve it. Welcoming your calls and emails when I speak with Laura Hagen in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. First, a programming note. In just over 2 weeks, on June 3rd, WMNF Summer Fund Drive begins, and I'll be raising money on Talking Animals on that very day, Wednesday, June 3rd. I'm typically assigned a giant fundraising goal, especially for a one-hour show, so I've learned over the years that the only real prospect of reaching such a big goal is to receive pledges before the fund drive show. How about today? So I'm hoping you might consider donating, ideally again before June 3rd. Any amount, $35, $50, if you can swing more, $100, $200, maybe $400, would be greatly appreciated. With Trump stripping away funding for public broadcasting, success with these fund drives has become more important than ever. So just go to WMNF.org, look in the upper right-hand corner for donate now. Just follow the prompts and then eventually you'll see a drop-down menu where you can direct your donation. Please select TLA for Talking Animals so that our show is credited with your donation. Thank you very much. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Dahl Stanley, Justice for Animals senior campaigner for the longtime animal welfare organization In Defense of Animals, regarding some pointed criticism of the sentencing a judge recently handed down in a high-profile case involving the poaching of 13 alligators. In this case, authorities originally charged the key defendant, Jacob Latreal, with 14 counts of felony counts of illegal killing, possessing, or capturing of alligators. Basically, was sentenced to probation, ultimately. So we'll get the main details when I speak with Dahl Stanley later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation about several current circus elephants with Laura Hagen, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Emailing DJ at WNF.org or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Laura Hagen to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So, of course, we'll delve into this elephant situation in a moment or two. But to help establish some context, let's briefly discuss your organization and actually a bit of your background as well. So forgive me if you feel like this has come up many times for you or others already, but you're with Humane World of Animals, which was formerly known as Humane Society of the United States. Now, that name change wasn't implemented after just 5 or 10 years, but more like, I think, 70 years after operating as the HSUS. So tell me about that change, the process behind it, and what kind of shift in communication and messaging it represents.
Yeah, thank you for asking. We're really excited about the change in our branding and the change in our name because Humane World for Animals really represents who we are and who we have been as an organization. We're a global organization who seeks to get to the root causes of animal cruelty across the globe. And we always have been. But when we were formerly known as the Humane Society of the United States, as well as Humane Society International, publicly, we were putting that work into two buckets rather than a global framework. And so our name now reflects that global framework, and it also helps to reduce some of the confusion that came at times, you know, from being confused with local humane societies. You know, we really want it to be clear who we are, what we're doing, and where we're working.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it seemed like a key element of this is there's so many organizations locally that do great work that are have Humane Society in their name somewhere that I know there was often confusion about where's my money going if I donate or who's going to help me with this situation. So I'm sure that's immediately like a huge change just by changing to Humane World for Animals. So are you guys pleased with the change and has it accomplished what you kind of set out to do? Because that's a pretty major seismic shift after that many years to change the name.
It was. It was an undertaking publicly as well as behind the scenes, you know, where we weren't just shifting our logo, we were shifting how we operated internally and everything we do internally from our emails to our SharePoint sites to our website, right? All of that had to be changed. But I think it's been a really positive shift and people seem to have responded very well to the change and are identifying with our new brand, which is very exciting for us. And I think that the new brand is really giving us an opportunity, as I said, to kind of tell our story globally, to think more globally all the time, and to really help people to understand that no matter where they are in the world, these issues fall into a greater context and that they can make a difference anywhere that they are. So I think it's really been a very, very positive shift for our organization.
I think a lot of people may be excused for thinking that the focus of the work was in the wake of the name change is different just because of things that seem to pop up more frequently under the Humane World for Animals banner. So does that, are people reading that correctly?
Can you say that again? So you,
yeah, just seems like certain campaigns and efforts, whatever, seem a little bit different in the wake of the name change. So is that consistent kind of with what you were setting out to do and sort of reshift the kind of work that you did and the focus of the organization?
Yeah, I think our work is fundamentally the same, right? But I think that we are talking about it in a more contextualized way, right? So we're not just talking about captive wildlife in the United States. We're making sure to contextualize it globally. We're not just talking about, you know, fur sales or fur farming in the EU, we're talking about it globally. And so I think that might be where you or others, you know, might perceive a shift in messaging, but it's all work that we've been doing all along. We're just making sure to bring the full picture to the table so that our supporters know that we're not doing anything in a vacuum and that we're really looking at all of our initiatives as a strategic global campaign.
Yeah, and it might just be sort of circumstantial too, because it seems like there's been a few things that have been related to, you know, raids and sort of huge cases of hoarding or cruelty or whatever that just seems like have kind of come in the more immediate wake of the name change. So maybe it just presents that, but that's just circumstantial that those things happen during that time.
I think probably, you know, our animal rescue team has been working in the U.S. and around the globe for years doing both companion animal rescue, the Envigo rescue, zoo facility rescue for years. So I'm glad to hear that it feels like those initiatives are getting more visibility because they're so important.
All right, cool. Well, now let's get to the Laura Hagen part of the story. So your story actually seems to suggest a lifelong advocate and protector of animals. And we meet all kinds of animal people on this show, not surprisingly, obviously, including those who volunteered at shelters, walking dogs and so on, others who became attorneys to make their animal advocacy more muscular and effective, let's say. And still others who focus their efforts towards legislation passing and bolstering animal protection laws. But you seem to be all of these people rolled into one. So Tell me about this. When did you first start deeply caring about animals and why?
Oh, gosh. I first started caring about animals. I mean, I'm one of those people that just had an instinctual care for animals as a child. You know, I was begging my mother for a pet when I was a young girl. And she thankfully, my mom took me to a city animal shelter and we got our first dog, right? And then that was my first real connection to animals. But it grew over the course of my life. I learned about factory farming and, you know, incorporated my care for animals in my diet. And, you know, for a long time, I've worked in the public sector for my entire career, but I did start, you know, volunteering at a local animal shelter. And that really just, you know, when I started doing that, I realized this was the public sector that I wanted to be in. This was the service that I wanted to be in. And so I did. I started volunteering in animal shelters, and then I got a job at the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I started there as a veterinary assistant, and then I did program work. And that was also where I learned more about advocacy. You know, I'm one of those folks who their relationship with animals kind of started with their companion animals and just kind of direct care. But I didn't have a lot of exposure to advocacy and politics in my life growing up. And so when I was at the MSPCA, we were working alongside other animal protection organizations on a ballot question in the state to prohibit greyhound racing. And they were collecting signatures. And I said, I can do that. So I went and sat at a shopping mall for hours every Saturday trying to get signatures. And somehow that didn't deter me. And I really just got hooked on advocacy. And I was so fortunate to be hired as a lobbyist with the MSPCA. They have a lobbying arm. They're a unique agency or a unique state organization in that aspect. And then, yeah, as you noted, then once I had done that advocacy for a few years, and that was when I started working on circus issues, then I decided it was time to go to law school. And I went to Lewis and Clark Law School, which is in Portland, Oregon, and I focused on animal law and environmental law. And that was why I chose the school. And I've just been plugging away at animal advocacy policy ever since.
Yeah, so really, I mean, it's just one of those paths where the next thing, say, hey, I really like this. And again, it could have been something entirely different, just circumstantially again. But it happened to be the advocacy thing that really spoke to you and then said, hey, if I really want to do this, I'm going to go to law school expressly for this kind of purpose and with this kind of focus. And I mean, obviously, there's a lot of attorneys in this realm, but I don't know how many of them went to, once they were partway down the path and with the express purpose of getting that kind of degree with that kind of emphasis. So everything seems like every step you took propelled you to the next step. And all about advocacy, really, ultimately.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like it's deep in my bones at this point as an animal advocate.
Yeah, for sure. Well, no, I'll just move on to something else. I'm really interested in the advocacy thing, but that's, you know, we're going to talk about a specific form of advocacy in a sec, so I probably should get to that. So this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Laura Hagen, Managing Director of Wildlife and Humane World for Animals. And we'll be discussing this kind of a jarring circumstance that a full decade after Ringling Brothers halted the use of elephants in their shows, it turns out that some 14 elephants in their mid to late 50s, no less, are still regularly forced to hit the road and perform in other circuses. If you'd like to ask Laura a question about these touring elephants or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Okay, so let's talk about these elephants. So elephants and circuses of all places in 2026. I guess there's a lesson there, because I found it jarring myself, and I feel like I've followed these things pretty closely. But I guess if for better or worse, as Ringling goes, so goes other things. I think many of us felt like once the Ringling situation was solved, quote unquote, it'd be easier to take your eye off the ball a little bit and not be looking out for what you're kind of mostly here to talk with us about today. I just wouldn't have guessed there'd be that many still in circuses. I know there's always a few here and there you hear about, especially at Renaissance fairs or little tiny circuses. But maybe we should sort of take a moment to ask you to explain why it's kind of detrimental for an elephant to actually be touring or performing in a circus to begin with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, starting from the top, you know, in the noting, which is important, that all of these 14 elephants were taken from the wild as young animals. So these were all animals who were born in the wild. And in the wild, these animals live just dynamic, varied lives in community with other elephants. Asian elephants, you know, roam up to, you know, 4 to 13 miles a day. They forage for up to 20 hours a day, foraging for food and water. They live in dynamic matriarchal communities where they stay together for the entirety of their lives. And they, you know, are part of a true family as an elephant herd. And what happened to these elephants is just egregious, right? They were taken from those families. They were taken from that dynamic life, and they were placed in not only in captivity, but the absolute worst type of captivity, right? They were forced to, at the end of a bull hook, you know, which for folks who aren't familiar is a long fireplace poker. It's a stick with a fireplace poker type heavy metal head on the end of it that has a hook that's used to poke and hook the elephants. And the exhibitors use that to force these elephants to learn how to perform the silly and just archaic tricks that are used in these circuses to quote unquote entertain audiences. These animals are deprived then. They've gone from these dynamic lives to an absolute life of deprivation. They're kept at the end of the bull hook. They're forced to be where a trainer wants them to be when the trainer wants them to be there. Simple natural behaviors like moving their trunk to feel around and to explore the world around them is corrected with a tug of that bull hook on their ear or on their very sensitive trunk. They're kept in housing that is just deprived of enrichment. They are frequently chained, most frequently chained when they are off the road and when they're not performing. So these animals who would roam for hours every day in the wild, who were born into that life, have then now spent the last 4 to 5 decades chained, confined in an unenriched space. And then for a good portion of the year, they're forced into semi-trailers and onto the road, where they are then unloaded in urban, rural, suburban communities, parking lots, arenas, all forms, any place, right, that these circuses, fairs, Renaissance fairs, as you noted, car dealerships, you know, the places that these elephants are hauled to and show up is just mind blowing. And it's, if you compare the life that these animals were promised when they were born to the life that they've lived for decades now, it just breaks my heart. And I think it does to anyone else who can really start to understand, how shallow and, just boring and unenriched their lives are today.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about over the many years on this show, when there was an ongoing aim to, especially again with the focus on ringling, to get elephants out of circuses, is just the incredible sophistication and emotional complexity of these animals. So I feel like with the way they're carted around in trucks or trains and then the bullhook training, which you noted, and all these things. I mean, you're just obviously breaking their spirit, and they're just, it's a horrible life. So some of these are, I guess many of these elephants that are in this group of 15 that we're talking about are in their 50s. So I guess that's kind of what they've known for decades at this point.
Yeah, you know, when I got started on this issue, I first started working on a bill to ban elephant and other wild animal acts in Massachusetts in 2008. That was my first piece of legislation that I ever worked on. One of the things that as I started learning more about this, one of the things that really hit me was that most of these elephants have lived in these barren captive environments longer than I've been alive. You know, we spent a decent amount of time at the top here talking about just my history in time, you know, kind of building this career in animal protection and animal advocacy, and all of those years and all of the, you know, wonderful things I've had the opportunity to experience in those decades. These animals have been chained. They've been separated from other elephants. They've been hauled around, you know, they've been deprived of everything for decades. And the amount of time and the way that these animals suffer really was what drew me into this issue and made me want to continue to fight against this for the rest of my career, because this just isn't acceptable.
Did you kind of piece this list together, Laura?
Yes. Yeah. We follow, you know, we track all of the captive elephants in the United States, and we track the elephants that are still being used, you know, in traveling exhibits. And, you know, certainly the number continues to go down. When Ringling was on the road, it was much more. At one point, some folks were reporting, you know, 100 elephants had been on the road at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Ringling closing, and of course with elephants passing away and dying, that number is getting smaller and smaller. But what's really, you know, just so frustrating about the fact that these 14 elephants are still on the road is that it is clear that wild animals do not need to be used in circuses to bring crowds, to provide entertainment, to provide a family-friendly evening out. It doesn't require wild animals. And, you know, 2 years ago, even Ringling came back with an animal-free show. You know, they are smart business people, and they see the market, right, for circuses that don't feature animals. And there are so many circuses, Universal Circus, Royal Canadian Circus. There are so many of them that have gone animal free in, you know, the last decade or so. But these last six exhibitors are just intransigent. And, you know, I think I honestly believe for many of these elephants, they may work them until they die. And it's just the saddest thing, because it's so unnecessary.
So maybe talk about just a few. It sounds like you know these elephants well from just all the years of tracking this work and working in advocacy and trying to get better lives for these elephants. So talk about maybe a few and the exhibitors who own them and what the prospects are. It sounds like you feel like there aren't really any prospects of getting them out of this life, so no one's going to be persuaded to send them to a sanctuary, let's say, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think about Betty is one elephant that has been on the road. She was on the road in 2025. She's owned by Cardin Circus. Cardin is based out of Springfield, Missouri. Betty's 57. So she is a very elderly elephant. She was captured in Thailand. And, you know, Betty is really interesting because when we look back at, you know, all of these circus exhibitors have to be licensed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they inspect the circuses. And so we can see on inspection reports through the years that, you know, Betty has been lame and stiff, suffering from likely arthritis for a very long period of time. You know, the USDA cited Cardin Circus in 2011 for Betty and two other elephants who were visibly stiff when they were giving rides and when they were in the circus ring. And I should add that the captive life that they lead, the fact that elephants are constantly chained, the fact that they frequently only live on hard surfaces like concrete when their bodies are made to walk on, you know, packed dirt and grass and that type of thing. It really impacts them physiologically, and it causes arthritis and lameness. I mean, you imagine standing on concrete for 40 years, for 50 years, what that would do to your body for the vast majority of the time. And that's what we've seen in Betty. So 2011, which was 15 years ago, the U.S. Department of Agriculture cited Cardin for failing to provide her care for her stiffness. And then again, last year in 2025, the agency again cited Cardin because they saw Betty at a circus. She couldn't bend her, what's essentially her wrist joint on her right front leg. And Cardin was still using her for rides. They were piling 5 to 6 people, kids and parents, on top of her. And the USDA noted in their inspection report that as soon as people were loaded on her, Betty was visibly worse. She slowed down when she was giving rides and, you know, was clearly in pain. And the exhibitor, Brett Cardin, said, you know, yeah, he was aware of it and had actually been given anti-inflammatory medication by the veterinarian. But the USDA said it was clear that she was not receiving either the medication at all or the amount that she was supposed to get, because it was clear she was in visible pain. And Brett Cardin's response was, well, we just have her do rides and she just usually warms her way out of it. You know, like she'll walk a while and then she'll be fine. That's the solution, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that attitude is what does make me a little bit pessimistic about these facilities, you know, ultimately moving these animals to sanctuary. And, you know, one thing to note is that all of these exhibitors have, you know, roadside zoos where these elephants go when they're not traveling. And so I think that the most likely outcome is that when we get these elephants off the road, which we are going to do, you know, they are likely to end up at those facilities. And we'll continue to push for them to be surrendered to sanctuary. That is the ideal outcome. And so we're kind of taking one thing at a time. We're going to get them off the road first because that makes their life harder. We're going to get them out from under a, you know, bucket full of children that they have to walk around in a circle, get them off the road. And then we're just going to keep going until, you know, we can see a better life for these animals.
Yeah, I think sort of on a related note, one of the photos that I used on social media and elsewhere in advance of our conversation today, Laura, it was a circus elephant. But if you looked carefully at the top of the image, you could see there was two kids' shoes, sets of shoes there. So obviously there was two kids on top of the elephant's back that weren't really primarily provided in the photo. But, you know, bad enough this is dressed up as a circus elephant. And then if you look carefully, they're also giving rides right now, too. It's like, well, that's a double whammy if ever I saw one. And so let's talk a little bit about it, because it sounds like phase one from what you just outlined is let's get these elephants off the road. So talk a little bit, if you would, about, you know, over the years, there's been many cities and states that have passed ordinances outlawing performing animals. So I would hope these ordinances would continue, and I don't know what the status of that is. I don't know how many there are, because that's obviously not preventing some of these exhibitors from taking the elephants on the road and doing circus performances. So is that still kind of some active legislation in various municipalities and elsewhere to outlaw performing animals?
Yes, emphatically, yes. We are working very hard on this issue at the local, state, and federal level as an organization that, you know, really believes in the power of change that can be made via legislation. That's for humane warfare animals. That's our primary focus in this space, is passing more laws, whether at the state or local level, to prohibit these acts. And I think that, you know, what we've seen, you know, when Ringling announced that they were when they announced that they were no longer going to tour with Elephants, they specifically cited to the changing legislative landscape. They cited to also changing public opinion, but that was reflected in the changing legislative landscape. Before Ringling closed, you know, local laws had been passed in major cities in Texas and California, and then the state of California passed a bullhook ban. New York and Illinois in 2017 banned the use of elephants in traveling acts, and then we've been continuing to work on it ever since. And so that was part of what took Ringling down, essentially, and turned them into the animal-free circus that they are today. It was that legislation that made it more expensive and more difficult for them to do their job, which was to cart these animals around, right? And that was their moneymaker. So it made it more expensive for the cost. And so we've continued to work on that today. Today, there are 12 states that prohibit the use of elephants in some form, as well as other wild animals. It varies state to state, but all 12 of them have some provision relating to prohibition of, you know, traveling elephant acts. And what we've seen is that it really makes it much, much more difficult for these outfits to make a profit, and especially for these smaller exhibitors who don't have the financial resources that Ringling did. You know, our goal is to continue working at this and make it more complex, make it more expensive, and make it more difficult for them to use these animals. And the most recent law that was passed was in Washington, and that was in 2025, and that prohibited the use of elephant as well as other wild animal acts in Washington. And there were elephant acts. I believe there may have actually been an elephant act in Washington on the day the bill was passed, finally passed out of the legislature. And so we shut down Washington, right? California was shut down in 2017, and then again in 2019 when they strengthened their law, you know. And so we want to shut down the whole West Coast, right? We want to see Oregon go next. And so there's been a really great change. And then we've also continued to work on the local legislation. Just earlier this year, an advocate in Marquette, Michigan, where Cardin Circus, who owns Betty, that I mentioned to you, where Cardin Circus had visited for a number of years with elephant and other wild animal acts, a local advocate there, you know, had been protesting for years. And, you know, Cardin was interviewed and went on the media, and they were talking about, you know, how the wonderful care they provide to their animals. And, you know, she knew different, right? She had read our materials and other advocacy materials and knew what it meant for an elephant to live a life on the road and a life doing tricks in a circus. And she said, I'm going to do something about this. And she worked for over 2 years with her local city council, just having conversations, educating them about the issue. And she was successful. And it was the 200th local ordinance by our count to pass in the United States. And, you know, it was in a conservative region of Michigan and the Upper Peninsula. You know, so this can happen anywhere. And so we are continuing to talk to advocates and encourage them to work locally. And we support them all the time, because every city and every town that says no to these acts makes it harder and more expensive for these exhibitors to continue traveling with these animals. And that's what we're doing. We're essentially disrupting their supply chain.
Yeah.
And
is there any particular effort, I guess, anywhere you can get a ban like that implemented is great. But I also couldn't help wondering, in a way, as I was thinking about this, you were describing this, about if there's any sort of geographic element, like if you look at a map and it's like, hey, if we could get a ban here, then the routing of the of XYZ circus cardiner, whoever it might be, will be blocked, and just making it more frustrating and difficult for them to just advance anywhere. Is there that kind of strategy ever employed in terms of trying to pass these ordinances?
Yeah, we employ both types. So both a strategic looking at where the animals are going and looking at where we have a political opportunity to make a change, right? We have to put both of those things, you know, kind of into the pot when we're thinking about where to pursue legislation. But I always tell advocates that even if a circus isn't coming to your community, that it is helpful to pass proactive preventative legislation, because as more states and as more cities say no to these acts, they're looking for other places to go. And so the more cities and towns and communities and states that we shut down, the better. So we work with advocates on both fronts, and we work on state legislation on both fronts as well.
Yeah, I wonder in a weird way if Ringling being out of the picture, just because they were so often a focal point and everybody, you know, kind of universally known, for better or worse, them not being a part of this discussion, does that limit what otherwise would have been an easier way to galvanize people in certain areas where there's ordinance being worked on?
Yeah, you know, it is interesting, as I've worked on particularly state policy, and this does come up locally sometimes as well, but I have run into this with legislators who, you know, I'm talking to them about the circus and wild animals that are used and how they suffer, and all of the data and information that we have. And they're like, well, does that even happen anymore? You know, isn't that over, right? They think that because Ringling closed, as you said at the very top, then the problem was solved. And that's just simply not true. You know, we know that these elephants have continued to suffer on the road for the last 10 years, even though Ringling closed its doors to animal acts.
Yeah.
And so that is definitely a perception that we have to fight against. And so to do that, you know, we track very closely where these animals are going, when they're performing, so that we can say to legislators, no, this elephant, you have had elephants in your community, you know, in the last several years, or they may come here. They're going to the community next door. They could just as easily come here. So we do keep a close eye on where these animals are going to help to tell that story and make it really clear that these animals are still on the road. They're still being chained. They're still living at the end of a bullhook. They're still being hooked with a bullhook to do rides, to do performances. And they just don't need to be. And local and state legislators can do something about it.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Laura Hagen of Humane World for Animals, formerly Humane Society of the United States, as we discussed earlier in the program. We're discussing that some 10 years after Ringling Brothers removed elephants from their shows, 14 elephants are still regularly forced to travel and perform in other circuses. So we're in our final moments of talking with Laura, but if you have any questions or comments about that, you're invited to join the conversation. 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So Laura, people listening to the show, I'm sure, will be surprised, if not outraged, that it's going on to this extent. How can we bring pressure to bear? What would you say to people listening, steps they could take to sort of help mitigate this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are several things, right? If there is an opportunity to work locally or at your state level, like, we would love to work with folks on that. If there's an opportunity to speak up on existing state legislation, I know we are all inundated with email requests and asks these days. But if you see something come through from our organization or another organization, whether it's on legislation or reaching out to ask a circus to stop using these animals or a shrine chapter to stop using these animals, please take the time to take that action. You know, we have an action alert up on our website that asks, you know, Shriners International to prohibit their chapters from using elephants in circuses. And nearly 40,000 people, you know, have signed that action alert, you know, asking Shriners International, because they play a big role in these elephant exhibits. They hire these exhibitors. And so, you know, if Shriners International would just say no, that would be, you know, another block of performances that are off the road. It's been recently reported that Jordan World Circus will not be using elephant acts this year. Jordan was a prolific elephant exhibitor, and they contracted with exhibitors like Cardin Circus and Carson and Barnes, some of the more notorious elephant exhibitors that are still on the road. And I think between the legislation that we've passed in recent years, Jordan World Circus was going to Washington and other states where we've passed legislation, as well as the direct outreach and the protests that other groups have been doing to Jordan World Circus. We don't have permanent confirmation that they're never going to use those animals again, but it is trending in the right way. So each business that we keep from contracting with these exhibitors is another win on top of the cities and the states that ban it. And so there are a lot of opportunities to speak up. And I encourage people to take it whenever they see those opportunities. You know, protesting is still effective, right? Show up. There are protests organized all the time when these circuses show up in communities. Speak out on social media. So much of the conversation around this happens on social media now. Speak up on social media when you see this is happening, and elevate this issue in your own community. And that's how we're going to continue to, as a community, really chip away and finally end these acts.
Well, that might be the perfect place to leave this conversation for today. So this has been Laura Hagen with Humane World for Animals. And again, the website is humaneworld.org, where you can find out more information about these very issues that we're discussing. And if there's alerts or other ways you can get involved, depending on where you're listening, to help with ordinances or protests or other things that might be another way to sort of stymie the ongoing efforts of these operators and exhibitors. So, Laura, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and for all your good lifelong work on behalf of animals.
Thank you, Duncan. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. In a moment, I'll speak with Dahl Stanley of the Venerable Organization in Defense of Animals, talking primarily about this notorious recent case involving the poaching of 13 alligators. The chief perpetrator here was initially charged with 14 felony counts, the illegal killing, possessing, and capturing of elephants, and pled it down to basically probation. Seems improbable or worse, and we'll hear the perspective of a serious-minded animal welfare organization and longtime activist. Dahl Stanley joins us in a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, then, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece from longtime fave Eddie Izzard. Here's Talk to the Animals by Eddie Izzard in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
But, you know, whales, they're intelligent. They do whale songs. We don't know what it means, but I think that whales are traveling at 78. They're traveling at 78 speed, and if we take them up to 45 speed, we'll find they're actually going, "Oh, I love you, baby. And if it's quite all right, I love you, baby. Well, then I love you, baby. Question me, love you." Yeah, they're DJs, you see. DJs of the sea. Because sound travels well in water, and they need a big PA to be a DJ, but they've got their whole bodies. Yeah, it works, doesn't it? This next song is going out to all the goldfish down by the Azores. I love you, baby. So they're intelligent, and dolphins, they're intelligent because we all saw the documentary Flipper. Well, dolphins came up going, "What's that? What's that, Flip? Chiang Kai-shek is having trouble. Ma Tse Tung has taken over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek has retired to Taiwan with some of his followers, where they will have a complete disregard for international copyright rules." Is that what you're saying, Flip, or do you want fish? Because every episode of Flipper, he'd say the same thing. He'd always having a problem. Like, "What's that? What? A boy trapped in a well, trapped in the water. Three boys fell out of a ship, a small ship, a big ship. Two syllables, big ship, small ship. Sounds like the deep, bit like the deep, bit of shark, jaws, da na na na, like that. What? Gone with the wind, okay. And they were all like that. There was Skippy. Yeah. "What's that, Skip? A boy trapped, drowning in a desert, drowning in a desert, in a desert. Ill, He's in a sandy place? What? He's ill? He's got a bad leg? What? Gone with the wind? And Lassie as well. What? You know, Lassie, Flippy, Skippy.
That was Eddie Izzard in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Talk to the Animals, taken from his album entitled Circle. It's time to speak with Dolph Stanley. Unfortunately, cannot reach Dolph Stanley so far. I've tried a few times. We'll try again momentarily. I hope we'll have it right here on Talk Animals on WNF momentarily. Stay tuned. Thank you. All right, thankfully we found Dahl, so we're going to speak with Dahl Stanley here on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Dahl.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So give us the elevator pitch a little bit on, for people not familiar with In Defense of Animals, give us a brief description of the organization, if you would, and then we'll get into the case specifically.
In Defense of Animals was founded in 1983 by Dr. Katz. And initially, we worked on vivisection. Since then, we've expanded, and we are an international organization. We work on just about every form of animal cruelty. Personally, I'm in our Mississippi office, the Justice for Animals campaign, and I work on cruelty cases.
Yeah, and you've been doing this for many, many moons, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes. I've been in Mississippi for 33 years.
That's great. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about this case. Tell me about the alligator poaching case and how you guys got involved with it.
Well, I saw it. One of the men was the organizer, and he took three other men with him on three excursions to poach alligators. And they took photos and videos. And, of course, that's how they got caught. Our distress, at first we were, like, great. And Fish and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you know, we're really concerned about wildlife and poaching and, you know, how seriously they take it. But when you see the sentencing that people are getting, it's absurd. The one who was organized, he got 36 months probation. He can't hunt or fish for 3 years. Do you think he's going to pay attention to that? He's been out poaching at nighttime. He'll work around that, and they probably won't catch him. Unless we start putting some teeth, not just into our laws, but into our sentencing.
Yeah.
And there, most states now have sentencing scheduled. The judge has to see if they have priors. They have to look at this. They have to look at that. And the reality is we've fought so hard for so long to get at least felony charges for animal cruelty, aggravated animal cruelty. That it's just very upsetting to see. Sometimes with dogs and cats, especially dogs, you might get a better sentence, but it's almost like there's a discrimination between species.
And also, go ahead, Dahl. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned the importance of having felony charges here. And if I'm not mistaken, this case did involve 14 felony counts of illegal killing, yeah, possessing, and capturing alligators. So then, like you said, I guess you wonder where the teeth is in the enforcement or the sentencing, and how that could get pled down to basically, like you say, probation, and you got to stop fishing for a little while or whatever.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it's absurd. One guy got 18 months. He got a $750 fine. And $100 court cost. Another fellow got, I think it was $550, maybe $553, he got probation.
So it might be too late, I guess, to get anything resembling justice in this case. But are there measures that you can recommend that can be taken to bolster the laws and give them more teeth in the sentencing stage?
And here, the general public, if they care about animals, has got to start stepping up and voicing, because the folks like us that are in the animal protection movement, a lot of times it's like, oh, it's them again. They're worried about who's going to vote them in, and if there's not enough people that are working to change the laws, well, naturally, they're going to worry about people laws first. But even there, they're letting us down. Look at the people who have all these rap sheets, and they're let out, and they kill somebody. In general, our justice system has gotten too lenient. Maybe not for everybody, but for most sentencing, from what I'm seeing and I work on, right now, I've probably got 50 cases going across the country.
Wow.
And it's very, very disturbing.
Is there something posted either on the IDA?
In Defense of Animals website, yes. www.idausa.org.
So that way people could find out the status of certain cases and what efforts are being made to strengthen the sentencing.
And they can participate by signing. I do not advise people to call prosecutors or directly email them. They're very busy. You're tying up their clerk. And why irritate them when you want their help?
Right.
So
it's not productive.
We write a letter. We send them thousands of signatures attached to the letter. We call them. We call them. And whenever possible, you know, if it's in from Mississippi, I've gone to Louisiana and Florida for some court cases. But, you know, understand that they have a lot of cases they're handling.
For sure.
And they want to expedite it. And for every case the state prosecutes, there's a cost. So
right.
It isn't just that they don't want to fill up the jail. It costs a tremendous amount of money, and that's why they do plea deals.
Well, Dahl, I'm afraid we're out of time. We got kind of a late start when I couldn't get a hold of you, but I appreciate your time and efforts, and people will hopefully go to the IDA website and look at how they can help. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye, Dean.
Bye-bye. All right, coming up on WNF is the conversation with Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter, then The Scoop, then back to music with Sandoval, 1-3, followed by Nancy C. Holding 4 from 1-3 to 6 p.m. We'll be back next week on Talking Animals on WNF Tampa.